respond? Is this working? Yes?
Okay. Oh, it's quite a little intense to talk right after that's over.
Sure.
I know you've been looking at the print this week to get ready. You've seen it a few times. What's it like seeing it after a period of time not having seen it?
It's quite strange, in particular because the way we made the film, I don't know how many of the audience are familiar with the way we made the film, but it was a no-budget film in the true sense. We got it to our first festival. We spent about $6,000 on the entire movie. So it was all myself and Emma and a group of our friends getting together each Saturday to shoot about 15 minutes worth of footage. We did that for about a year, putting together that way. So when I look at the film now, I see all these friends of mine who now all look a bit older. Luckily, I'm not in the film, so I see everything. And, you know, and I see all my stuff, some of which I still have, because all the props, all the things, they're all just our things. And so, you know, a lot of the film was shot in my parents' house, and, you know, I recognize that. It's, so the whole thing is, it's very interesting to see it, just on that level of watching these things from our past, particularly because the story, with its structure, everything is somewhat connected by the props of those kind of elements. And they're all just real things from our lives.
Wow. Well, now, at the time you made this, you were going to school in London. You had made some shorts. Were you looking for a feature idea? Did this idea just come to you? How did that all happen?
Well, we'd made a couple of short films sort of in using the production methodology that we wound up applying in this. A few years before, we'd actually tried to do a feature-length project and never really been able to finish it. And the limitations we did technically trying to make a 16mm feature film, we addressed some of those technical limitations and over a period of a few years doing a couple of short films, figured out how to get around some of those things. But some of it's a little obvious, things like shooting in black and white on colour, because when you have no access to lighting packages and the rest, you have to just do things on the fly. You can make black and white look, you can create a style with it in a way that you really can't with colour photography, unless you have some great resources. Introducing the film with voiceover, so the sound would be clean for the first couple of minutes. We did, and keeping it short as well, we tried to make the film as tight as it could be in terms of the series of events that was going on. And in fact, I actually wrote the script in this, according to the structure whereby, because the film expands outwards in all directions at once, you get the headline version of the film, the man bites dog, and then each scene is sort of expanding the story in terms of filling in the gaps between the events you've already seen.
Yeah.
And the thinking behind that is if we ran out of money halfway through, we'd have fun. But I think as it is, we shot everything that was scripted, apart from maybe one or two things that didn't seem so important. But we kept it as short as we could. So it's an hour and 10 minutes.
How did the idea come to you? Did it come? I mean, did it come in that kind of obvious way, or did it just gradually develop?
Well, I was living, as I said, I was living in London on Tottenham Court Road, just on Oxford Street, which is the west end of London. It's incredibly crowded, very much for tourists. So as soon as we went out of my flat, in fact, Jerry has seen walking off at the beginning, he's just walking out of where he used to live into the throng of Tottenham Court Road. I just became interested one day walking along with this notion of, instead of seeing, you know, a crowd of people, say, okay, who's that person? Where are they going? I didn't follow them around. Just sort of the notion stuck with me. And I just combined that with the experience of getting burgled, coming home and seeing a door to your flat smashed open, and realizing there was something about looking at the door and realizing that it was very fragile and anyone could have broken it down, it wouldn't have required any force. And you look at the window panes and they're made of it, so very easy to smash. So thing that stops people debating your life in that way. It's about social protocols. It's about respecting other people's barriers. And there seemed to be a relationship between that and the idea of not picking someone out of a crowd, following them, imposing yourself, stalking them, essentially. There seemed to be a relationship there that was worth it.
Now, I noticed that Emma Thomas is credited on the film. Did you meet her during the course of the film? Had you known her already?
No,
still your producer?
Long time. Still my producer.
Yes.
And why? Yes. She's here somewhere. Bigger films, where you sort of construct it from the ground up, it's unbelievably difficult to try and achieve those kind of textures. Just the, you know, the paint peeling the walls and the things, and there's so much skill that goes into the production designs are in terms of making that happen when it's artificial. Yeah. And so I think I've actually spent all the films since then trying to, you know, get the massive resources to get back to when we had nothing. It's a similar texture you want. It's just reality.
I remember once you said that the actors' haircuts were a problem because it went on for so long.
Yeah, I mean, Jerry was quite upset by having to grow his hair for that long. He didn't like the look of it for the long hair.
Yeah,
it's scrubbing. And Alex, he was just a, you know, lovely guy, but just turned up one day and he shaved his head. We were 2 days through shooting and he shaved his head. And in the same conversation where I was sort of staring at him, and as he was leaving for Australia in a month and kind of never coming back or whatever. And if you look, you know, carefully at the film, just there's a scene at the end where his hair is quite a bit different than it is across the film. Because he grew just enough, like 2 days before he actually had to get on the plane and film it. But it was, I mean, to be fair to the actors, you can't complain too much because it was a massive commitment. Basically saying, okay, it's going to take at least, I think I probably told them 6 months, like, why not being a year, that they had to kind of, you know, keep their appearance close enough. There's quite a lot of variation, like, if you watch it a million times.
What, I mean, you mentioned the thing about the texture of reality. I mean, this is kind of be an odd question. Do you miss anything about those days?
Yeah, I miss an enormous amount about those days. The spontaneity that you're able to achieve shooting a film in that way, where on most shooting days, the cast and the crew and all the equipment could fit into one taxi, one London taxi. And that gives you an incredible freedom. You know, we would go into a location, you know, no clothes, just favours, and, you know, everybody just doing this sort of for fun. And that does give you an enormous amount of freedom if you embrace the limitations. And obviously there are massive limitations technically to that, which could become creative limitations if you don't put them in the script. If you write the script knowing that you're going to have those limitations, then I think it becomes free. And I do very much miss the spontaneity. Certainly when we made Prestige, I talked a lot about production design and probably talked a lot about trying to get back to a very, very loose style of filmmaking. We shot that film with a lot of handheld camera, a lot of kind of similar setups, you know, in a weird way. Because, of course, one of the things about when you come for the lights, or you don't want to take the time to light, you want to let the actors be free. The best way to do that is to have a couple of big windows and get them to stand next to the windows. So there's a lot of people standing by windows. but funny enough, if you watch The Prestige, it's a lot of kind of tricks. And so what I did is he just tried to give us, you know, myself and the actors, the freedom to move around the place. And that is one of the things I do miss, because I shot the film myself. And you shot an old Arri VL, which is, it's quite a heavy camera. So you get it on your shoulder. It's very well balanced. And you could really just follow what the actors were doing and not worry at all about hitting marks too much and things like that. And that actually is a really fun way to work photographically as well as for the actors.
Now, you finished the film. I know you've got an excellent review from Alexander Walker, who was one of the top critics at the time. But nothing happened over there, and you ended up taking it to the United States. Am I spelling that correctly?
Or? Well, not quite really in that order. I mean, made the film in England, and I'm half English, half American, so it was, you know, the opportunity to bring the film over here and try and do something with it. And I think that the North American, you know, film festival circuit is really unique in the world. It's really unrivaled in terms of the access that festivals like Sundance will give filmmakers starting with absolutely nothing, no connection, and no avenues to film seen by anyone. There's really nothing like it in the world, I think. I mean, the festivals in Europe are bigger, more glamorous affairs. Some of the local films are quite small, but they don't tend to come from nowhere. You know, we were sort of getting a bit of a brick wall over there. So we started from at the San Francisco Film Festival and had a good time there, got on this rest of the circuit, and then really sort of finished up at Slam Dance. Had great screenings there, and it was a very great platform that was really secure distribution for the film. We got played, you know, in New York, and played for Film Forum in New York, and France actually got excellent distribution. I mean, in a weird way, we have to bring the film to America, do that, so then we can take it back to Europe, and then get it seen. And the film, for the size of the film, it was seen surprisingly.
Did Sundance turn it down? Is this story true?
I couldn't answer that. I'd be undiplomatic. I don't want to get in trouble with Jeff Gilmore or any of those guys. We were very happy to get Sundance. Yeah.
Was that exciting when Sundance took it on? Was that, since this is a Sundance night, was that an exciting thing to have happen?
It was fantastic. It's an incredible energy there. For people who haven't been to Park City, you go there, even, you know, the big festival, is somewhat scrappy in a way. They're projecting films in the library and and stuff. Slam Dance is the extreme of that, you know. And you, as Dan was reminding me earlier today, you have to go put your own posters up, and you go up and down the street, you know, suddenly putting your poster over. It's really an amazing time, and it's a really fun thing. It was really unique experience, and one we treasure.
I want to ask you one more thing about this film, and I have a couple of other questions, but I noticed the music and the sound more this time. It seemed that you must have really, that was a really important factor. I wonder if you could talk about what you put into that. It seems like there's a lot of thought and work went into that.
Yeah, we paid a lot of attention. The music was by Dave Julian, who has done all my films other than the Batman ones, which we did with Hans Zimmer and J.J. Howard, but, for example, The Prestige and Momentum, and we did short films together and everything, and he came up, I think, with a very interesting score. I wanted to do this kind of ambient thing, but with these peculiar rhythms as well and stuff, and I think it holds up very well. I was just pleased to hear it. The sound mix, we tried to be pretty spare with the whole thing because those were the resources we had. And when I listen to it now, I don't think I ever quite got to finish what I wanted to do in certain aspects. I think some of the dialogue is still too unclear and things like that. Yeah. So I was, one of the reasons I was in the lab looking at is that I want to actually, do one final sort of pass on it and remix it now and then, the resources to do it. But not to change the character of it, because the quality of the recording, the raw quality of the recording, is something I really kind of like. And funnily enough, on all my films, on the big films, you sit there on the dub stage, I get into a lot of arguments with everybody about wanting to always use the production tracks and not replace dialogue. Yeah. Because I think that there's a very tactile sense that those recordings give you, when you hear a bit of the footsteps, a bit of the room, a bit of the actual resonance of the voices. This is a pretty extreme example of that. But keeping a little bit of that texture in a big glossy film, I think, is an interesting thing to do. I also think performance, raw performance, if it's captured reasonably well on the microphone, there's no substitute for that. If you get the actors in and you ADR it, it's a mess. There are one or two things. There's one moment in there where I've actually just replaced one of an off-camera line with my own voice, just because I didn't have the actor, and I want to go back and fix that, because it makes me jump every time. Anyway.
It's interesting, obviously the leap you've taken from the film with these resources to the Batman films is enormous, but it really, they seem of a piece to me, and I just wanted to talk about how difficult that is to keep that kind of intensity and keep the kind of almost independent feeling. with a film that big? Because I think you've managed to do that.
Well, I think if I've managed to do it, it's because, it's the struggle. I mean, the struggle is, it's nothing to do with creative integrity or anything like that. I've been very fortunate in, particularly the Batman films, I was given an enormous amount of creative freedom. But just physically and logistically to try and kind of turn that oil tanker, you know, with the same facility you were doing a rowboat. Ultimately, it is impossible, I think, but you find ways to try and do it. And one of the ways I found is to work with the same people, the same director of photography, the same designer, and, you know, work with the same people on multiple films and try and develop a shorthand and a trust, because certainly the relationship I have with Wally, Wally Fister, who's shot both films, all my films since this one, which he would never lay claim to. But everything since then, he shot for me. And he, you know, we have a degree of trust where he'll let certain things fly and be a little looser about things because he knows that we'll use the best bits and, you know, make it work. And he's a great contributor in terms of maintaining some of that spontaneity in terms of making a film. And my production designer, Nathan Crowley, as well, shares my love of shooting on location. And I think for the entire process, as soon as you're in a real place, for everybody, from the actors outwards, everything becomes a little more real, a little more spontaneous, a little, people are able to create in a slightly different way than when you're on a soundstage. So those are the kind of things that help.
But it is, I mean, is it really, I mean, you just alluded to it, is it kind of the struggle to make sure that you can...
Yeah, I think it is, because I think the job for me of a film director on set is to be, I mean, I like to say it's to be the advocate for the audience on set. I'm supposed to be the audience on set. I'm supposed to have blinkers on, really be able to see what's going to be in the frame and how that's going to make me feel in the movie theater in, you know, 10 months' time, years' time. You can't be thinking about the process and the size of the process and the craziness of the process, you know, all these trucks and hundreds of people coming together to do this thing. That circus element of what large-scale filmmaking is. I think my job is to be immune to that, to just ignore it and take it for granted or whatever, and be focused on the particular shot. And in doing that, if you can get into that state of mind, you find yourself back where you were when you were making the small film.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting that you've been able to make that happen. It's not everyone who's been able to make that happen.
Well, I don't know if everyone even tries. I mean, everybody's different, every director's different. But for me, that's always been an important thing, is just to keep creatively doing the same process. I haven't really wanted to show any versatility in particular. Yeah, I haven't wanted to be, you know, another director. I just wanted to keep doing my thing and doing the thing that keeps me the most interested. You know, try to work in an instinctive way in that sense.
Well, you know, I think that's a good place to stop. We could go on for hours, but probably they wouldn't like it. So thank you for your time and thank you for your film.
Thank you.
So yes, we're going to be doing a reception across